I put in place a daily stand-up. So it was 15 minutes every single day. Every person in that department went around and said the three questions, which were, what did I get done yesterday? What am I going to get done today? And what's blocking my way? And I asked over and over again. They all thought that meeting was for me. Meeting wasn't for me. I had systems where I could see what they got done yesterday and what they're doing today. I didn't need a status up. The third one was for me. Is there something blocking you? Because if there is, when they say, I've asked this PM three times for this dimension and they haven't gotten it, then I step in, right? But the other two were for them all to be on the same page. Because the amount of time somebody's like, by the way, did you know, in reference to something someone said, is huge. But there's also this peer effect where they're making a public commitment to get something done, right? In front of everybody. And if they don't get it done that day, the next day when they say that's what they're getting done today, people will be like, you said that the last 2 days, right? There's a lot of value to that.
Welcome to Verify Infield, the Millwork podcast. Your host, Jacob Edmond, CEO of Duckworks, will be interviewing experts in the industry to bring you insights and knowledge about the latest trends, techniques, and challenges in millwork. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting out, this podcast is for you. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the world of millwork. Here's Jacob.
Recording now. All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Jonah. Today we have Jonah Coleman, and he is Scrum Product Owner, I believe is the correct title for energy, right? Jack of many trades and wear of many hats over there at Energy, and in the past in his career in millwork. So thanks for joining me today, Jonah.
Hey, I'm happy to, man. I'm a huge fan.
Awesome.
Listen to all your podcasts, big fan of what you're doing and how you're doing it. So I will point you, though, you got my title a little wrong.
Okay.
But check out our website. You'll see that I'm the Director of Awesome.
Director of Awesome. Oh, man.
Yeah. It took me a lot of years to get that title. It's great because I can just kind of walk around, and if somebody says, hey, can you help me out with this? I can say, oh, I really, really want to, but it's just not awesome. So can't. And then if somebody's doing something cool, I can say, hey, you have to let me be involved because it's awesome.
Absolutely. To get started, I know a lot of people listening to this, I know who you are, I have an idea of you, but I'm interested where you started in millwork. What was your first job in the millwork industry?
Yeah. So, it's that old Hollywood chestnut of programmer accidentally gets into millwork for 20 years and then gets back into software development after that. My wife decided she wanted to move to a small town because she found kind of her dream job there. But I said, oh, no problem. I can find a job anywhere. And all there were like gypsum plant jobs. So I went back to school. And in order to support that, I ended up applying for a part-time bookkeeping job at a millwork shop.
Really?
Knew nothing about it. It was the late 20s at the time. And I just fell in love. Like literally day one, they were like, you could just be a project manager. And it fell into that. I love everything about millwork. That was residential. That was a lot of fun. And then found engineering was kind of my core passion and love. Did that for a long time. I ran engineering departments from the very, very small to the very, very large in companies of various different sizes. Ended up at Wilkie Sanderson up in Minnesota, who is the kind of the woodworking side of the energy operation, same owner anyway, and fell back into software that way. I ended up kind of running as an operations manager up there and getting more involved in the business as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have kind of a similar background. So,
but you were a programmer before you got into millwork, right?
I was.
What's your background in programming? How did that, is that what you went to school for or you kind of were self-taught?
So both. The answer is both. I started off just as a hobbyist programmer. It was something that I got into as a very, very young child. And then, yes, I did go to school for that. But it wasn't what I wanted to do as a career. I honestly couldn't see myself, you know, taking something someone else down and just implementing that thing and passing it on. That was never going to be me. So when I fell into the woodworking industry, it was just a fortuitous time because everything was digitizing. Automation was becoming more and more prevalent in an industry that didn't have a lot of those skills. So I ended up being kind of the tallest short person. That makes sense.
Okay. Right?
And it was just perfect timing.
Yep. So obviously, you know, because I went to school for architecture, but if I were to go back again, I've always said I would love to do software, computer science, if I knew then what I know now. And similarly, getting into engineering, the software side of things is what really piqued my interest and what I enjoyed the most. And so for you, obviously having a background in that, in this industry, I imagine early on you were, was that what drew you towards engineering a lot, was the software and the kind of the programming side of things, the problem solving, I guess, more so?
Yeah, the problem solving is a lot of fun. Software, obviously, but a little more than that. So at that Bush woodworking shop, I wrote an ERP, right? Enterprise resource planning, just purchase orders, time clock, tracking parts type stuff, because we needed one. And there really wasn't one that we could find in kind of early 2000s, mid, late 2000s, maybe. And I ended up sharing it with 20, 25 shops were running it at one point. And really just engineering ended up being a nice central place where you could make changes to organizations. Engineering is positioned perfectly to be a change manager. And you've seen this yourself in your background. We've had this conversation before. And that's what brought me there more than anything, is that that was the right place to introduce new ways of doing things.
Yeah. And in most millwork shops, you know, still to this day, engineering kind of becomes the de facto IT department, it seems. You know, because most millwork shops are smaller, you know, don't have an IT staff or an IT person. But also those engineers are the ones interacting with probably the largest spectrum of software in the company. And it seemed to be the minds that get it the most, or maybe just we screw with things the most. I don't know, but yeah, I found that in my experience as well. Everywhere I went as engineer and then engineering manager, it was like, okay, you're the IT guy as well. And I think that does make sense, or at least in practice, how it works out is you're kind of the one who's able to, you know, they go to, hey, we're looking at, we need a solution for this. How can you, what do you think we could do? As well as you kind of have your hands in the most things to be able to affect change. Kind of drilling into that though, because from my experience, especially over the last year and a half, I've been consulting with a lot of companies and we work with a lot now, and you even more so. What are some of the kind of pain points, problems you've observed specifically around engineering that, that people sort of like, cause everybody, engineering is a pain point, I guess we'll start there, right? Everybody's kind of every owner that I talk to, it's, well, if I could get more through engineering, I could get more through my shop. My shop has untapped capacity, right? Or I could sell 10 more million, but I can't get the shop drawings or get it through engineering to get it to my shop in time, or some version of that, right? And everybody has a little bit of that. Or on the flip side, hey, I've got all this knowledge tied up in this one person, this engineer that everything's dependent on. I can't multiply them. I can't replicate them. What do you find is kind of some of the core reasons for that? And I know energy, you guys, you know, paired with the software, obviously is an operating system and a way to attack this. But in your experience, I know you've solved these problems in a number of ways at different companies. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on that and your philosophy around engineering?
Sure. As long as I warn you ahead of time that you're about to get me up on my soapbox. Kind of hard to get back down off of it. So, you know, if you're open for that, then I will spew molten, philosophy at you. So you do hear this all the time from companies. Engineering is our bottleneck. Engineering is our bottleneck. Engineering is our bottleneck. And there are two aspects to that. Number one, is it, right? Is it really? The thing about engineering is, it's the first place that you can see the inventory of work that you have to do become real. If you read the goal, Theory of Constraints, right? Eli Goldratt. If you haven't read it, you need to. Stop right now. Go read that. Jacob doesn't want me to tell you to stop his podcast. Stop his podcast and, and go read the book right now. It's the basis of nearly everything I believe.
If you're not a book reader, there's a graphic novel version.
Is there really?
Yes.
Oh.
We'll be back after a quick break.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
All right, that's fun. So, or listen to the audiobook, whatever you do, and then come back to Jacob's podcast, of course. Eli Goldratt teaches that if you want to find out where your bottleneck is on your shop floor, you just go out and you look where the inventory piled up. But how do you do that in the office? It's kind of conceptual, right? It's in people's heads. You need a system to make it visible. And that's one of the things that I push and we push at Energy. But without that system, at the cutting center, the router, the saw, whatever, when you see all the stuff packed up and you can't get it through, it's really the first step at which you just can't, you can see that inventory of stuff coming. So you may have made it a bottleneck by dumping too much work on it. There's nothing deep about that. You can make any step a bottleneck by delivering in lumps, right? We got nothing to do for a week. Now we got too much stuff that needs to get done. So that's thing one. First, you have to figure out, is it really a bottleneck? Thing two is, if it is, you should treat it like one. And that's where I really struggle with a lot of these millwork shops who go swear up and down that engineering is their bottleneck. And then they have engineering doing all sorts of stupid things, complying with all sorts of stupid rules that do nothing but slow down that throughput. If it really is your bottleneck, it's the thing which dictates the total amount of output of your entire millwork operation. And you're going to slow it down because you have some dumb rule that some guy over in your solid service department insists upon. You're giving up money. I don't understand that. So throughput is always the number one thing. Our whole industry believes that engineering is its bottleneck. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not, right? The second thing I see is, you kind of touched on it, that knowledge. We run our engineering departments by just finding one or two super duper smart A-plus players, and that's how we do it. And if we need another one, we got to hire another very expensive, very hard to find engineer. Instead, if you build up a structure for an engineering department, one which contains the knowledge within it in systems or processes or documentation, then it becomes very, very easy to add new engineers. I say this all the time. I am a super good engineer. I'm a very, very good engineer. But if I came into your shop, it would probably be 6 months before I was considered productive because I have to find out the hard way how we do things. When I program some corner on something and somebody comes to me and says, that's not how we do it here. Because you know this, you're doing consulting work. I did consulting work for a while. The way a millwork shop builds things came from God to the production manager on a stone tablet, or maybe a wood tablet, just, you know, to keep with the motif. That's the one and only right way there is to do it. Well, you know what? If you have a wiki where I can just go look up how we make a thermoform, I can be productive day one. If you have some shared knowledge where when somebody screws up something, everyone finds out about it and understands what mistake was made, we can all learn as a group. Another thing I say, again, I'm a super good engineer, but everything I know about engineering, I learned by wrecking something. I wrecked a material. I wrecked a machine. Sometimes I wrecked entire projects. And the result of that is I'm a very good engineer now. And if you need to get a way to have group learning instead of individual learning. And the third thing I see really boils down to having an engineering department whose structure and processes are not aligned with the business's needs, right? Every business has a position in the market, something that's special about them. It's how they make money. This is really Michael Porter's argument that we, again, there's books you can read on. But since the beginning of time, there are only two of these positions. You can either be the lowest cost provider, or you can have something different about why people are willing to pay your company a little bit more money. That's it. There are no other ones. It's just those two. And lowest cost provider you can make money doing that. It can be very profitable. Walmart makes lots of money. It's hard. It's literally the hardest way to run a business that you can pick, because you have to stay on the very, very border of the efficiency frontier. You know, if you have some special machine, I can buy that machine. You just have to buy it first and then get whatever window of time before the next one comes along. We can copy ways of best practices. That's not a problem. The second thing is to have something special about your business, right? It could be a geographic area. It could be a special line of products that you could do. It could be something about your speed. There are a lot of things it could be. But if you don't align your engineering department to match that, and a lot of people don't, then you're just going to be fighting it all the time. It's going to be the thing holding you back all the time.
Yeah.
How's that? So, I gave you three.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. And I agree totally with all those. I think that that third one I want to drill into, you said that. So the first two, I think, are pretty self-explanatory, make a lot of sense, right? The third one, though, and this, I think, has a lot of baggage with it, you have to run your department not aligned with the business's needs, right? Or the business goals. And what I find, or I guess one aspect of this that I find every owner I talk to is a lot of it is them coming to me, and it's kind of like, hey, I have this engineering manager or this lead engineer or whoever it is that they see as an obstacle to the business's goals, right? And it's like, hey, we have this person. We can't afford to lose them because they're the safe set of hands. They know everything about engineering, but all that knowledge is contained in that person, right? And they also don't like change. They won't change. They won't, you know, and so the owner usually, like, the business starts to work around that person. Anything that is not, hey, the way that person likes to do things, it's like, well, we got to find another way to get around this person, right?
Uh-huh. And so
a lot of times, almost every time, the owner is coming to me in the consulting need and say, hey, can you talk to this person? Can you help me solve, like, how do I keep this person? How do I get them to change? How do I get what I need without having to address this person, right? If you're listening to this and you're an owner or you're in an organization, you probably are picturing a person in your organization. Because I can't, it's time and time again, it's been the same story.
Oh, I could name several names. Yes. Right now. I'm with you.
And so the problem with that is that what's happened is the owner and the organization has somewhere along the way stopped developing and managing that person, and instead is using them as a tool that, hey, let me just, like, basically we're accepting that this person won't change. We're accepting that the business needs them too much to force them to change or to replace them and to go through that painful process. And so what you're doing, though, in effect, is you're holding back the rest of the organization and all your other people for this one person. And you're doing more destruction to the greater good of the organization. But ultimately, that person is not aligned with the business's goals. And as such, your engineering department and what you need from it is not. And a lot of times because I've done engagements where I try to coach this person, but if I'm not their manager, I don't own the business. And in between when I meet with them and give them goals or say, hey, this is what you should be doing. Or even when I meet with the owner and say, hey, all you got to do is X, Y, and Z. Nothing changes in between those meetings. And what really has to happen is ownership, that leadership has to take that person and say, hey, look, this is the direction we're going. And this is the hard part, is the change management, hey, what you're doing doesn't align with the business's goals. You have value here, and it might be you need to go hire another person. It might be that person would be willing to change. They just need to see why and the vision or whatever it is. But
100%.
Too often, that person, that department, whatever it is, gets stuck in, hey, look, I've figured out a way that works, and I'm comfortable, and I've been doing it for 10, 15, 20 years, and changing is hard. Changing is confusing, and I don't even remember why I started doing it this way, but I do it and I'm comfortable and whatever, right? And so engineering becomes the goal for them. Engineering becomes the goal, and you'll see this a lot with drafters of, hey, I'm making perfect shop drawings. That is the product. And there is nobody in that organization casting the vision and continually managing and saying, hey, no, guys, what we do here, what everybody does here is the product that is installed on site for the client, right? And so if what you're doing is not yielding the result there, it's not, you're not doing your job. And constantly bringing that back to, okay, maybe we have been doing shop drawings this way for 20 years, but did that make sense then, or does it still make sense now, right? And everybody around you has changed. We've got a new shop supervisor. We've got a new machine in the shop. We've got a new material we make this out of, whatever it is. Like, you got to constantly be reevaluating and reframing that. And so all of that goes into leadership and management. Ultimately, is you have to, if you have not done this, you have to start doing this, but managing those people to the goal, not to like keeping them in a bubble. And a lot of times that's what happens, is when you have those people that are difficult and you have managers that are not equipped to deal with conflict and actually managing people and saying, hey, look, this is what I need you to do. You end up with this just non-communicated, hey, I'll keep you in a bubble, and everything that's outside of that goes around you. And I know that you guys encounter this a ton, I'm sure, with energy implementations and things like that right now. It's all about change management and basically getting people to, hey, look, here's a new tool, here's a new way of doing things. And it's all aimed at this goal, and anything that is not, I guess this goes kind of to non-value added work, right? Is, hey, is it contributing to what the client's paying for? If not, it's non-value added efforts, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, man, I got about 100 things I want to say to everything you just said. I have a whole spiel. I have about a 90-minute presentation on engineering for owners so that they can understand. And that, why did they ask you to talk to them? Because you speak their language. Many owners don't know how engineering works or what it does or what the right way is to judge the output. It's just this black box to them that they pass in. We need these drawings, and somewhere 6 weeks later, they get a set of drawings and then it's all wrong, et cetera. Couple of things. So number one, no one's going to change until the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of changing. That's just how it is. And so sometimes you have to engineer that pain if that person doesn't feel it. You touched on this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. Sometimes it's easier to change people than to change people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Always a problem. And then when you make those choices, if that person really doesn't fit and they're never going to get it, they're going to go eventually. They're either going to get sick and tired of it and they're going to leave, or you're going to go. You're just drawing the pain. So we like to call that saving the dog some pain by chopping the tail off 1 inch at a time. You know, bad news doesn't get better with age, so it's better just to make your choice now and move on. I'm going to take a step back. I think a lot of engineering managers don't actually understand their company's position in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. They don't understand what it is that's special about that company. And they just end up optimizing their local department, right? Let's make engineering the best it can be. Many people think it makes sense to always do whatever you're doing the best you can. And so I have an analogy I give. And I'm sorry for this. It's going to be a little involved. So I like to do this. We're going to talk about the goal. And we're just going to set up a hypothetical, you know, cabinet shop, right? And I'm going to give you some numbers, Jacob, and it should be kind of interactive between us. So if I have, and I'm going to measure in cabinet boxes, which is a stupid unit of measure, right? In job shops, we're really selling production time, but you got to have some measure. So. Yeah. I have an engineering department that can program 55 cabinets in a day. I got a cutting center that can cut 60 cabinets in a day. I got an edge bander that can edge band 200 cabinets in a day, which is pretty normal. Edge banders can move faster than the cutting center. And I got a cabinet line that can do 30 in a day. How many boxes in a day will I assemble?
30.
Absolutely. And so if I'm an owner and I go down to IWF next year, and I buy the world's fastest, shiniest new edge bander. Man, it could do 500 boxes in a day. How many products will I ship in a day?
30.
30. That's right. I did nothing. So improvements to non-bottleneck steps are illusion. That's one of the primary teachings of the book, The Goal. Right? So my favorite example is light valance. You know what light valance is? It's a little L-shaped trim, or sometimes just not L-shaped. And they use fasteners. Goes behind the doors on upper cabinets to keep you from seeing the trim. It's like 2 inches wide usually. Nobody can band that. So in every shop, they cut it like 4 1/8 inches wide, and then they make their assembly line, rip it down the center after the edge band or edge band is all aside. Mm-hmm. But we just said in our scenario that our bottleneck was in assembly. So every minute that those people spend working on something other than putting products together is a minute that we've lost and we can never get back. So we go to the edge banding operator and we say, you can run 5 times as fast as anybody else here. So what I would like you to do is jump through this flaming hoop by building a sled to push the 2-inch pieces through, or you are the one who rips it down, or you tape the pieces together and then you band them, et cetera. And if we do that, we make more money. But that person is going to say, this is inefficient for me. And they are right. They're 100% right. They nailed it, right? So that's a case where if they optimize their local department, then they are more efficient, but the system as a whole makes less money. And the same is true for every department. We can optimize drafting at the expense of the rest of the company. You gave some perfect examples of that, right? Dumb rules are the number one thing you see. If companies create a new rule for every scenario that they ever ran into, just in case it ever happens again, and you trade off the one-time expense every 5 years for now you have slower throughput for all of time, right? That's not a good choice. Not a good choice at all. But they don't know any better. And because they don't see the big picture of what their company does that's special and how they make money, they focus on what they can control. They get obsessed with yield, right? They get obsessed with the best G code to cut 15 seconds off of a program. And that's not how we make money. We make money through throughput.
Yeah. No, I think to summarize what you, or at least in my dumb brain, a lot of what you just said, which triggers kind of a lot of things in my brain that make sense now, is essentially engineers. I know. Engineering so often optimizes their realm, optimizes engineering with the tasks that they do at the expense of everybody else in the organization. That happens very often, you know. So for, and a lot of it is like, hey, you know, I will only do things this way. And if it's not put in this folder, if it's not given to me in this format, I'm not going to touch it. And so, and yeah, and it's like, okay. And a lot of times we will tell engineers, hey, push it back until they give you the right information, right?
Sure.
But a lot of times within engineering, like they optimize things without consideration for, is this great, you know, feeding the greater goal, but also, am I creating more work elsewhere? An example of this, I had a client that I was in, consulting with, and if they're listening, they're going to know I'm talking about them. Sorry. They would do die walls when you had a radius die wall, and there was this constant battle between the engineer, who himself used to be a custom bench guy and he ran the shop many, many years in the past, and the current bench guy. And the current bench guy would say, hey, look, when you give me a radius die wall, I need to bend panels around this, right? And I don't want there to be waves and stuff. So you've got vertical studs. I've got radius plates. Can you give me intermediate radius ribs that are half lapped or whatever, right? To help with this, right? And the engineer would say, well, that takes me a bunch of time because I don't know how to use microvellum. I have to go draw that out in 2D plates and then put it in Alpha Cam or whatever it was, right? They have got, basically for me as the engineer, that is more work. So instead, I'm just going to give you 3 times as many studs, shrink the spacing between your studs to accomplish the same thing. That was his philosophy, right? Hey, just put 500 studs instead of 30, right? And there was this constant back and forth. And he was like, oh, well, when I built walls, that worked fine. And it's easier for me as the engineer. And I'm in there saying like, okay, look, but you're... bench guy is asking you a reasonable request, and your job as the engineer is not to engineer as fast as possible. It's to get the net end result, the quality that is needed as fast as possible. And so while, yeah, maybe you can, it's easier for you to just say, hey, times 30 on the stud instead of times 10. That's more material. And it's not a yielding, building that desk faster.
And, but I'm gonna jump in and I'm gonna challenge you a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's just like everything. You know this. You as somebody who knows millwork, all the time people say, what's the best fill in the blank? What's the best way to do this? What's the best way to build that? And the answer is always, it depends. Anybody who answers a question like that without getting details is just trying to sell you something, right? They're trying to sell you their software or whatever it is to say our way is the best. If production engineering in that scenario is the actual bottleneck, the company could make more money that way. Now, probably not. And when you can automate something, so in your case, it should have been easy to automate the better outcome, then it changes the scenario. But there are times when it makes sense to send something less engineered to the shop floor because you're going to get more product through. What's more expensive than a shop standing around with nothing to do? And you know you can't see a shop with nothing to do. You've never seen a shop with nothing to do because the available work is a gas and it expands to fill the container. People just go slower.
So in this scenario, the net result was that the engineer was sending extra studs. The bench guy was throwing them away and just manually cutting his own radius ribs. So both were inefficient and wasting material and taking more time. And it was like somebody, the manager, leader of both of them at that point needed to come in and say, okay, guys, we need to compromise. I don't care which way we do it, but we have to decide together. And whatever we do, whatever engineering puts out, production has to use. And if production is not going to use it, then engineer, I need you to change to something he's going to use or vice versa. And that is a microcosm. It's a small example, but that happens so much that I guarantee you, if you're an owner, if you go spend some time in your shop and start digging, you're going to find many examples of this. You had no clue was happening in your organization. And that was the stuff that would drive me crazy, especially as a consultant or an engineering manager, as I would come into an organization and ask the engineers, oh, yep, nobody knows what they're doing. They just need to do things my way. And we have to engineer it this way because the shop only does it this way. And I would go to the shop and say, hey, engineering's telling me that you guys have to do everything this way. And that's why they spend all this time in engineering. And the shop would say, oh, we don't even know that they're doing that. We totally ignore that. We have our jig over here that we use. And so there's this like, one, people within the org aren't communicating to solve the problems together. And it's, you know, a lot of times engineering may be solving it in a valid way, but it doesn't matter if people aren't using that, if it's not actually yielding the result.
Well, I got a story to share on this. But I do want to just throw the caution out there also. You can't just let production rule the company.
No.
Right. You know that. I see it in your face. But the production people are probably the least well positioned to understand the interactions with the customer, the promises that have been made, what it is about that's special about your company. Everyone needs to hit this. They need to figure out what is their special position in the marketplace. And then they need to double down on that and make sure everyone understands, because then the painful things you have to do are a little more palatable. So my story is this. I came into a company as an engineering manager. This was a company that had separate drafting and production engineering departments. And that made sense for them, given their position in the market, which I'll talk a little bit about later, but that was the right choice for that company. But their production engineers only talked to their drafting department via shop drawings. If it wasn't on there, back it goes, right? Got a shop standing around with nothing to do and a set of shop drawings that literally just needed one extra word on it, back to drafting it goes, and we'll just let the shop sit around idle, right? So I ended up doing a lot of things with them. First things first, like week one, we sat down and the entire group and I said, I got bad news. We're restructuring and we have eliminated every one of yours positions. I'm sorry, those jobs don't exist anymore. And we're going to do some things, right? We'll set up, make sure that we have some benefits. We're not cutting you out to dry. We're going to take care of you. But I'm sorry, I don't have these positions for you anymore. You feel free to apply for the new positions in the new department, which is a unified engineering department. It still has design engineers who do drafting and production engineers who do production, but it is one department that works together to produce product. Because to your point, that is what we're here to do. Otherwise, there's a whole lot of things that as a drafter feel really good as a drafter, but unless your business is making shop drawings, which I guess this is awkward because that's actually your business. But unless your business is making shop drawings, that's not what we're here to do, right? And as a good outsourced drafter, you probably understand that and you help your customers get what they need. Because we could make the Taj Mahal of shop drawings. We could make a set of shop drawings that literally everyone in the world would look at and say, well, that's it. You did it. That nobody's ever going to do better than that. And if you compare that to a set of shop drawings that was good enough, where good enough means that everyone understood what needed to be done and the dimensions, the sizes, it's not the Taj Mahal, but it got approved and it went through production. How much more money did I get paid for that Taj Mahal set of shop drawings?
Nothing.
Nothing. But how much more did it cost to produce? A lot more, okay. Right? So in that department, we ended up doing a lot of things. I put in place a daily standup. So it was 15 minutes every single day. Every person in that department went around and said the three questions, which were, what did I get done yesterday? What am I going to get done today? And what's blocking my way? And I asked over and over again. They all thought that meeting was for me. Meeting wasn't for me. I had systems where I could see what they got done yesterday and what they're doing today. I didn't need a status up. The third one was for me. Is there something blocking you? Because if there is, when they say, I've asked this PM three times for this dimension and they haven't gotten it, then I step in, right? But the other two were for them all to be on the same page. Because the amount of times somebody's like, by the way, did you know, in reference to something someone said, is huge. But there's also this peer effect where they're making a public commitment to get something done, right? In front of everybody. And if they don't get it done that day, the next day when they say that's what they're getting done today, people will be like, you said that the last 2 days, right? There's a lot of value to that. We also did rounds once a week. So once a week, I would take the entire group out onto the shop floor, and most of them were remote. So we carried out tablet. And we would just go up to people, craftsmen working on the shop floor, and say, hey, how's it going? And we wanted real feedback. Now, ahead of time, I told them, you need to listen to everything people say. Don't argue with anybody. You're only going to take action on a quarter or a half because you're going to get a lot of this guy wants it one way and that guy wants it another, right? When you got 30, 40 craftsmen, there's just no way to not get that. That should have been a screw and that should have been glued. And it'll be the same guy saying the opposite thing next week.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some amount of good. And I also prepared the shop. So the very first day we went out and I found somebody working on something I programmed. And I said, I want you to rip me a new one when we come ask you about this tomorrow. And this was just the right guy for the job because he's like, not a problem. I was going to do that, you know? So that very first day, I took my entire crew out and they got to watch that guy tell me everything I did wrong. And it's okay then, right? We set the precedent that it's okay for someone to say you should have done it differently. And that interaction, that forced feedback cycle between the drafters and the production engineers is missing in a lot of companies.
Most,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they just keep doing what they do, and then the production keeps complaining about it, and they think that these guys are morons, and they think that these guys are morons. And it's really easy to think somebody's a moron when you're not talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's that's really great advice that is very hard to put into practice for a lot of people for some reason. But it's uncomfortable at first. You know, I mean, the idea of having a one-on-one and having a face-to-face meeting, you know, it's awkward the first few times, you know, but as you do it and it becomes muscle memory and getting critical feedback. And I think that is that first part you said, the daily stand-up, which can exist in many forms. And today's it can be virtual, you know, but what's important is that as a manager, you're one understanding what's blocking your people, what obstacles, because that is your job as a manager is to go remove obstacles, right? The schedule should be set. Everybody should already know. And you can do that without a meeting. Hey, here's your task list. Here's what needs to be done. Everybody should start the day already kind of knowing that, right? But reviewing it and they're creating that accountability to where everybody knows, because this happens too often in engineering departments is people kind of just live in their little holes without accountability. And it's things go in that black box and hopefully eventually they come out. And the biggest problem is nobody knows when they're going to come out and there's no accountability or expectation given. It's just nobody knows how to tell that engineer how long it should take him. Okay.
And it's unpredictable.
Right. But we should be able to tell him when we need it. And he should be able to tell us, I can do that or I can't. And so having that meeting also, like, it gets everybody used to that. And you refine that process and you get better at predicting, hey, look, you're saying this, you're not going to be done, because the next thing that happens is those people are going to start sandbagging. Well, I don't want to be in the meeting saying I'm going to be done tomorrow and then I'm not done 3 days, right? So they're going to start telling you longer. And that's okay at first, right? Because you're going to start to sense that and you're going to push back. Well, I know you're telling me Friday, but I think you could probably do it Thursday. And as they start beating their dates, you're going to find that out. The second part, well, yeah.
Remember though, in the beauty of the stand-up is their peers, they're talking. Mm-hmm. So as a manager, I almost never had to do it.
Right.
Because when they say, I got this die, well, it's going to take me 4 days. And the guy next to him, like, I could do that in 2, right? And as long as you don't, you'll get whatever you measure. So if you suddenly start saying, like, we're going to have a daily, it's Friday and I want to have a performance review with you. You said you were going to get this thing done on Wednesday, but you didn't get it done until Thursday. And so I'm going to go ahead and dock, whatever it is. Yeah, you'll get bad behavior that comes out of that. So for me, it was important to keep it just at that peer pressure level to avoid exactly what you just said.
Right. The second part about going out to the shop. I mean, that's really how I learned most everything in this industry. I mean, I worked in a millwork shop, but when I started working in cabinet shops, I had never built cabinets myself. I worked in a door shop where I fabricated, mortise and tenon style and rail doors. And so I understood woodworking and joinery and machinery and stuff. But I was learning as I was engineering cabinets. And for me, I spent 4 years in architecture school where the way it's designed is basically you spend a bunch of nights not sleeping, making a project that then your professors and all their peers are going to tear apart in front of everybody, right? So I had 4 years of practice of getting, my ass reamed out and had to get used to taking very critical feedback and learning the hard way, how to do that well. So then going into a shop environment, and saying, hey, I want you to tell me what I did wrong as an engineer so that I can do it better next time. My goal as an engineer was always, I want to be the guy that the shop asks for on the hard stuff. I want to be the engineer that when they see my initials, they're like, oh, thank God. This is going to, even if I don't know, they know that they can come to my desk and say, hey, I'd rather, can you change this? Can you do that? I want that dialogue so that they don't think that I have too much ego to learn. Because one, I also was the young guy, and coming to this industry as a young guy, everybody assumes you're stupid anyways. So I just kind of adopted that mentality, and still to this day, it helps to just be dumb and assume you're dumb and assume that everybody has something to teach you. And that's very difficult for a lot of people to kind of have that mentality. And it's hard to take critical feedback, but forcing that interaction and preparing as a manager, if you're in that position of getting your engineers say, hey, look, we're going to go walk the shop floor and we're going to go talk to the guy building this, and he's probably going to rip you a new one. And I expect you to take that with a grain of salt I'm not going to let him be disrespectful to you, but we're going to actually take the feedback and learn from it and not argue about it. And that in itself is a skill that you develop over time. How do I communicate with these guys who are probably going to give me feedback in a less than palatable way? But how can I extract from that something that says, hey, okay, I've heard what you said and I'm going to improve that for next time and actually, help you. Basically, that's the goal from it, is that they're going to, through time, see that I give this engineer feedback and he learns from it and he helps make my job easier in the future.
And engineers tend to be a little defensive. So honestly, the hardest thing for them to learn seems to be able to say, you know what? I screwed that up.
Yeah.
I don't know why. We want to defend to the debt. It's not that important. Swinging back around, I think it's the most important is how you get everybody to understand why your engineering department needs to be structured a certain way to support the business. So in most companies, the owners don't know anything about production. They were woodworkers. They know that into things. They accidentally became business people. They now know that into things. Nothing of how engineering works. And so the structure of their engineering department is just happenstance. It's just whatever people they came across, hired, however it happens to end up being. And so my favorite two examples of the last two companies I worked for, because they're so different. So I worked for a company called Wilkie Sanderson. Their market position is on time every time. That's what they do. They have lots of extra cost in their structure based around keeping a project on time and managing the customer. And they therefore go after customers who are willing to pay a premium for that kind of service. They book sports events because Beyonce is booked on December 7th. That place will open come hell or high water on December 7th. And they are willing to pay a premium for that performance. The prior place was Architectural Arts. Architectural Arts is the fastest guns in the West. No one can put 2,000-6,000 hours of production into production like that. Last project I PM'd there was $750,000, something like that, of custom paneling, die walls, some weird funky cabinets. And it was like 6 weeks from beginning to end. And that's not unusual for that company. That company has lots of extra cost structure around being fast. Now, that isn't to say that Wilkie isn't reasonably fast. They're reasonably fast. And Arts is reasonably on time. Every big successful millwork shop is reasonably good at all the things big successful millwork shop to do. It's just not what they're special at. So if Arts, and once you know this, decisions become easier. Hard decisions become easier. Should Arts go after a project that doesn't actually produce for the next 3 years?
No,
because they don't have any particular advantage at that. And all of their cost structure will be wasted on a customer who doesn't really value it. Should Wilkie go after hospital remodel work? Absolutely not. Those are impossible to keep on track because every stakeholder, every nurse, every doctor, they all get their say, right? So hard decisions become easy. And that boils down to what's engineering structured like. So at Wilkie, part of our strategy was we would do shop drawings before we got the project. We would do $1 million projects shop drawings, and we would submit the shop drawings with our bid. We would say, hey, here's our price. And by the way, we already began shop drawings. Because every GC's been burned by a millworker who couldn't get their drawings done, right? And so for Wilkie, it was important to get lines on paper. And their projects were usually a ways out with a very firm end date. But then they would spend that next year value engineering, trying to figure out, all right, we'll build some mock-ups. Oh, that's not going to actually work. We'll figure it out as we go. I told you I had a project that was 6 weeks beginning to. For Arts, there is no later. There is no later, right? It's got to be figured out up front. And also, they do a great deal of work where they're taking somebody else's drawings and they're not even drawing anything. They're just engineering from it, sending it out to the shop. And there is a different skill set between drafting and production engineering. Mm-hmm. In drafting, you have to know kind of how much can you get away with drawing it your way, but still achieving their outcome. And just pure engineers often don't have that skill set. So for Arts, I chose a structure that was combined, right? Everybody does both because it made sense. 15 people who could be put on drafting at the same time or engineering at the same time because we only had 6 weeks to get it done. And we have to figure out the details up front. At Wilkie, I thought it was correct to have a drafting department that's just doing vanilla AutoCAD drafting because it's fast and it's not that important that it's accurate. I mean, it's accurate enough. Don't get me wrong. They're very, very good drafters. But, you know, it was more like 5 and 5 for production versus that. And if I didn't understand that, and if it was just pure happenstance, if you had the wrong department in the wrong company, if we switched those, then they would be disastrously bad, right? So I always say engineering can be a force multiplier. So if you do it right, it can make everybody else's work generate more output. Mm-hmm. It can be less than one multiplier also. And that is 100% what would happen in those. And in those companies that where the engineering didn't understand the market position of the cost of their company, their engineering managers would optimize for their department.
Right.
And that they would, everyone would hate them. Everyone would talk about how slow they are. They're the backup. They're the bottleneck, et cetera. And they would work around them, just like you said. And all that stuff comes to be. So figuring out, first of all, what is your market position? What's special about your company? And then making sure everybody understands it is important. Again, at Arts, you know, I remember I was kind of just doing drafting there when I first started. I can remember us sitting around being like, oh, what we wouldn't give to just get a simple school job. Why does everything we do this complicated stuff? Mm-hmm. And now we understand that it's hard, right? Because it's hard because that's the kind of work where people are willing to pay the money that Arts gets.
And what's interesting neither of those did you say their differentiator was quality. And I think that what's funny is for too many people, too many companies out there, that's what they would say. Oh, we're the best at what we do. And it's interesting that there can be that many bests in this industry.
Quality is not a differentiator. Right. Every big company has decent quality, has reasonable quality.
It's just an expected default baseline, basically.
That's right.
So
same with customer service. People will throw that one out. Yeah. And so specifically, these aren't my arguments. These are arguments that come from lots of different books. And so Michael Porter is the five forces and the market competitive advantage stuff. And he addresses, those are not differentiators. Right. They cannot. Those are just things you do in service of differentiating, right?
Right.
Just like when we talk about the goal, and you should definitely do the book club, the goal. I personally did the book club, the goal, with groups of PMs, estimators, engineers. I like to have a mixed group so that everyone gets to hear each other's, including people from the shop floor.
Right.
But you'll learn that the goal is to make money. But there are some things that are not the goal. The goal is not world's best G code, world's most optimized nest patterns, most efficient labor. Those might be things we do, but they're not the goal in and of themselves. Right.
All right, everybody. That concludes part one of this discussion with Jonah Coleman. We had a really long and eventful conversation. Part one, we talked mostly about engineering departments, and the conversation is far from over. So next week, if you join us, we'll continue the conversation. You'll be able to get part two of this interview with Jonah, where we discuss energy design, their new engineering software. So trust me, you don't want to miss it. Remember, that's next week right here. Take care and stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Do you want to stay up to date about industry insights, new content, and our community of millworkers? Go to duckworksmw.com to sign up for our newsletter. I'll see you in the next episode of Verify in Field.